So earlier I mentioned the Jataka tales, the traditional Indian folk tales that were co-opted by the Buddhists to become stories of the Buddha's previous incarnations. The traditional story is that in order to become a Buddha, you really have to purify your karma. And so over multiple lifetimes, you do all these wonderfully compassionate acts until you finally have purified your karma enough, and then you get to be a Buddha. These Jataka tales are the source of a number of Aesop's fables. Remember that Alexander the Great made it as far as the edge of India, and there was a lot of trade between the kingdoms he left behind and back to Greece. Some of those kingdoms became Buddhist. There's an extra canonical work called The Questions of King Milinda. And King Milinda is identified with the Greek king Menander. And his kingdom was a Buddhist kingdom in what is present-day Afghanistan. And so if you're on a trade route and it gets dark, what are you going to do for entertainment? You got to tell stories. And so the stories went back and forth with the caravans between Greece and India. And so we can see how they arrived there. We now have a spider arriving here. Not quite going to work. Got a larger piece of paper or a smaller opening. Aha. You have a device. Once upon a time, there was this spider. Once the Buddha was born as a banyan deer. A banyan deer is a deer that has so many antlers that it looks like a banyan tree turned upside down. And when the banyan deer grew to adulthood, he became the leader of the herd, and for many years he led them in safety in the deep woods. But things change, and in the human realm, a new king came to power. This king felt that it was really important to stay fit for war, and the best way to stay fit for war was to go hunting. He liked nothing better than getting up at the crack of dawn, mounting up on horseback with the other members of his court, getting some bush beaters to go out and chase the animals, and then riding across field and over the river and through the woods, killing anything he could find. Bears, lions, tigers, deer, lots of deer, rabbits, pigs. Bring him back to the palace for a feast. He was quite proud of what he was doing and felt that it kept him fit for war. However, his sentiments were not shared by everyone in his kingdom. The members of the court were used to a more sedate life. They didn't particularly like getting up at the crack of dawn and spending the day on horseback. Townspeople didn't really like it because, well, sometimes the king's soldiers would show up at their shop or business or whatever and announce to them that they were being a bush beater that day. Don't open your shop. You're going out and beat the bushes and scare up the game. Kind of bad for business. But the people who hated it the worst were the farmers. Nothing worse for your crop than the king and all the members of the court come riding across your field, trampling all of your crops. In fact, it was the farmers that came up with the plan. And they told the townspeople. And the townspeople told one of the ministers that they felt might be sympathetic to their cause. And that minister went to the king and said, "Your Majesty, this hunting is indeed keeping us fit for war, but there's a problem. You see, from time to time, we go trampling a farmer's field and destroy his crops. This could cause a famine, and if there were a famine, we would be in such a weakened state that any enemies would be able to attack us. We wouldn't be fit for war." The king was like, "Yeah, but the minister says, "Don't worry, we have a plan, Your Majesty. What we'll do is on the edge of the great woods, we'll build a giant stockade, and then we'll drive game into the stockade, make a viewing platform, and you can mount up on the walls of the stockade, and then you can hunt from the walls. This will allow you to keep your archery skills up. You'll still be fit for war, and the farmers' fields won't get trampled, and we won't have a famine." The minister didn't mention the fact that he hated getting up at dawn, or even that the townspeople didn't like being bush beaters. He figured this was good enough. Well, the king thought about it. It didn't really seem like the good way to keep fit for war, but yeah, if there was a famine, that wasn't going to work too well either. So very, very reluctantly, he agreed to the plan. He thought, well, we'll try it out and see. So the farmers donated some land that wasn't particularly good for anything else. And they and the townspeople chopped down a bunch of trees and made a huge stockade, so high that nothing could jump over it. And then they went deep into the woods and they drove two herd of deer into the stockade. One of the herd was the herd headed by the banyan deer. And after they had driven the herds into the stockade, they went back to the palace and said, "Your Majesty, come and see. We have the stockade stocked and are ready for you." So the king rode out along with some of the members of the court, mounted up to the viewing platform. He was quite impressed. It was a very huge stockade. In fact, the far wall was so far away that, yes, it was going to be quite a challenge to shoot accurately. He looked over the two herd of deer. He was quite impressed with the herd of deer as well. He quickly spotted the leaders, and he said, "Ah, these two leaders are magnificent indeed. They are under my protection. No one is to harm them." And then he took his bow, and he fitted an arrow, and he began shooting. There was 5 minutes of terror. Some of the deer were killed by the arrows. Some were wounded by the arrows. But many of the deer were wounded by the hooves of their fellows as they tried to get out of the way. After the 5 minutes of terror, the king said, "Go collect supper," and rode back to the palace. And so they collected the deer that had been killed and went back and had a feast. This went on for about a week. The king would ride out, mount up to the stockade, and the 5 minutes of terror would happen again. After a week, the Banyan deer went up to the leader of the other herd and said, "Brother, I've tried to find a way out of this, but the humans have built the walls too tall and too strong. I don't know how to get us out, but I think I do have something that perhaps will lessen the suffering. Some of us are being wounded by both the arrows and the hooves of our fellows, as well as many of us being killed. What I propose is this. Each day, all the members of one herd, first my herd, then your herd, will draw straws. And whoever gets the short straw must go and wait under the viewing platform and present themselves to the king. It won't stop the killing, but at least we won't be injuring each other, and there won't be the injuries from the arrows." The leader of the other herd agreed this was not an ideal solution, but it was better than the current situation. The next day, when the king arrived, there below him stood one deer trembling, and all the other deer were back at the other end looking to see what would happen. King said, "Ah, these are magnificent beasts indeed. They have apparently chosen to send one of their members by lot. Shoot the deer that waits below, leave the others behind." And he turned and left. And so one of the courtiers dispatched the deer waiting below and brought it back to the palace for supper. This went on for another week with someone from the palace, not the king, he didn't come anymore, coming and shooting the deer that waited below. After a week of this, the lot fell to a pregnant doe in the other herd. She went running to the leader of her herd and said, "It's not fair that two should die. Please, let me wait until I've given birth to my fawn and weaned it, and then I will take my place." The leader of the herd said, "You know the rules. Whoever draws the short straw must go and present themselves to the king." In desperation, the pregnant doe went running to the Banyan deer and again explained her plight, saying, "It's not fair that two should die." The Banyan deer looked at her and said, "You are correct. It's not fair that two should die. Go." And so she ran back to her herd, overjoyed. But now the Banyan deer had a serious problem. It wasn't even his herd's day. He couldn't very well ask anyone else to take the pregnant doe's spot. When the member of the court showed up to shoot the deer that waits below, there was the Banyan deer. Well, now, this presented a problem. The king had said the two leaders of the herd were under his protection. They were not to be harmed. And he also said, "Shoot the deer that waits below." Contradictory messages at this point. Nothing to do but send for the king. A message was dispatched to the palace. When the king got the message, he looked at it. It said, "Your Majesty, come to the stockade. An astonishing sight awaits you." The king mounted up and rode like the wind. He arrived at the stockade, bounded up the steps two at a time. Upon arriving at the viewing platform, looked down and saw the Banyan deer below. "Banyan deer, what are you doing here? You know you're under my protection." The Banyan deer looked up at him and said, "Today the lot fell to a pregnant doe. It's not fair that two should die. As leader, I've taken her place. I have my duty, you have yours. Shoot." King was completely startled. It had never occurred to him that he might have to sacrifice his life for one of his subjects. But he did have to admit that the Banyan deer had a point. it really wasn't fair that two should die. Banyan dear, you have provided me with a very valuable lesson. In appreciation for this lesson, you are free to go. The Banyan deer looks up. That won't do any good. You'll just kill someone else. No, I have my duty, you have yours. Shoot. Well, now the king was really shocked. Being king, that also meant he was judge, and at times he sentenced someone to death. And then sometimes he would say, but if you're out of the kingdom by sunset and never come back, you can live. And when he passed this get-out-of-jail-free card to someone, they never said, go ahead and kill me. They always took him up on it and left as quickly as they could. And here the Banyan deer was turning him down, his chance for freedom. But once again, the Banyan deer did have a point. If the Banyan deer left, the king was just going to kill some other deer. You are a magnificent beast indeed, Banyan deer. In appreciation of the wisdom that you have and the depth of the lessons you have taught me, your whole herd is free to go. Now are you happy? The Banyan deer looked up and said, no, won't do any good. The burden will fall twice as hard on the other herd. No, I have my duty, you have yours, shoot. Well, now the king was just like, oh, God. Once again, the Banyan deer had a point. Yeah, instead of shooting the other herd every other day, it's going to shoot them every day. It will fall twice as hard on them. Okay, Banyan deer, you and the other herd can both go. Now are you happy? The Banyan deer looked up and said, well, if we go, you'll just resume hunting the other animals. You'll just go on with your killing. It won't really do any good. No, I have my duty, you have yours. Shoot. That's exactly what the king had been thinking. Chase off these deer, go back to hunting. Banyan deer, you are both brave and wise. You are free to go, your herd is free to go, the other herd is free to go, and we won't hunt any animals. Now are you happy? The Banyan deer looked up and said, even as we speak, your men are out with their nets, trapping birds and killing them. No, I have my duty, you have yours. Shoot. All right, look, you can all go. We won't kill any animals, we won't kill any birds. Now are you happy? The Banyan deer looked up and said, who will speak for the silent ones, the fish and the rivers and the lakes and streams? No, your men are out with their hooks and their nets, trapping the fish even as we speak. I have my duty, you have yours. Shoot. The king turned to the courtiers. He said, this is my royal proclamation. From this day forth in my kingdom, no one is to harm any wild creature, no animals, no birds, no fish. He turned back to the Banyan deer and said, now are you happy? The Banyan deer looked up at him and said, yes, and he leaped high into the air. The gates of the stockade were thrown open. The two herd of deer went back into the forest, even deeper than before. The king ordered the stockade torn down. And on the spot where the Banyan deer had leaped high into the air, the king had a stone cairn erected. And on that he had a plaque. And the plaque showed a deer with many antlers leaping high into the air. And around the outside was written the words, never cease to care. I like this story because it's a really brilliant illustration of the four Brahma Viharas, the four divine abodes, the four emotional states that are supreme. First of these divine abodes is metta. Metta is usually translated as loving kindness, although lately I've seen it more being translated as loving friendliness. But I want to translate it as unconditional love, because that's really what it means. It's loving someone just because they're a someone, not because of what they'll do for you, or they have done for you, or you hope they'll do for you, or anything like that. Unconditional love. It's the same as the Greek word agape. The Greeks had multiple words for love. There was eros, erotic love, philos, brotherly love, like Philadelphia, and agape, unconditional love. Loving just because there's someone there to love. And this is what metta is about. Metta is wishing the best for someone. It's an open-heartedness. It's because it's unconditional. It's not about someone deserving love, or if you're doing it for yourself, yourself feeling like you deserve love. It's just recognizing that all of us would like to be happy. May we have the circumstances that bring happiness to us. Good health, safety, peacefulness. Whatever you think would make someone happy or make you happy, you wish that. Like all of the Brahmaviharas, metta has both a near enemy and a far enemy. The far enemy is the opposite, and the opposite of love is hate. Pretty obvious. The near enemy is something that looks like love, but is, well, not quite the same thing. The near enemy of love is attachment. Wishing the best for someone because you're attached to them. You want this person that you really like to be happy. Or you want them to be happy because if they're happy, they'll make you happy, or whatever the reason is. Now, I will admit that if you like someone a lot, you're liable to become attached, and your metta is liable to have these twinges of attachment in it. To check if it's real metta, if you're in a situation with someone that you love and they want to do one thing and you want to do something else that's incompatible, can you wish that the thing that be done be the one that's the best for the other person? It can be a challenge at times. This is just one way to work with this. As I mentioned earlier, metta practice is a very, very potent practice. And if they were to say to me I could only do one practice, I had to choose, I'd choose metta without a doubt. Metta is to be given to yourself and to all as to oneself. So it should be given without any limits to everyone in the universe. Now, sometimes it's real easy to give love to everybody in the world, but some of the people you know may be more difficult. It's a practice. You do what you can towards being open-hearted towards them. Sometimes I teach in a prison back in Massachusetts near IMS. And the guys there were saying to the people who teach there regularly, yeah, there are people in here that it's actually dangerous to do metta for. I don't want to wish these guys to be happy because they're happy when they're beating on me. Well, I had some phrases that were different from the usual phrases. Her first phrase was, may I be free of enmity. Or may you be free of enmity. May you be free of hatred. Well, you can certainly wish that to the difficult people. Next phrase. Sorry, gone blank on it. May you be free of hurtfulness. Well, the difficult people, yeah. If they'll stop being full of hurtfulness, they'll stop hurting me. That's pretty easy to wish. May you be free of troubles of mind and body. Well, if this difficult person is having troubles of mind, that may be why they're so difficult. And so if they could get over their difficult mind states, then maybe they wouldn't be so difficult. So that's pretty easy to wish. And maybe part of the problem of them being so difficult is they have troubles of body that are just making them ornery. So you can even wish that. And the fourth of these, may you be able to protect your happiness. Well, that one may seem to be a little more difficult until you realize the only happiness that is protectable is happiness that's gotten through wholesome actions. Happiness gained through unwholesome actions, through bad karma, is going to have, well, bad results. There may be some temporary happiness along the way, but the unwholesome actions are going to lead to unwholesome results eventually, and therefore happiness gained in that manner can't be protected. So it is possible to wish to a difficult person, may you be able to protect your happiness, because what you're wishing is, may you gain happiness in a wholesome manner. And yeah, if they're gaining happiness in a wholesome manner, then they're not being so difficult. So even the difficult people, it's possible to send metta to them. Now, I like to think of these four Brahma Viharas basically as a diamond with metta at the top. Metta is the feeling inside that inspires the others. A famous spiritual teacher said, greater love has no one than they would lay down their life for another. And this is exactly what the Deer King was willing to do. He was willing to lay down his life for the pregnant doe. So this story illustrates the ultimate in love. Now, when love goes out into the world, it sometimes encounters dukkha, and sometimes it encounters rejoicing. When love encounters dukkha, it responds by doing what it can to alleviate that dukkha. This is karuna, compassion. Compassion is doing the best you can to alleviate whatever dukkha that you encounter. But for it to be compassion, it has to be done without attachment to results. If you're attached to the results, then what you have is usually referred to as pity. And you're also putting yourself in a situation where you'll be subject to burnout. The far enemy of compassion is cruelty, but the near enemy is pity. Let me help you so there won't be this dukkha in my world. Or let me help you so that I can feel good about myself. Or whatever motivation there is that's attached to the result and isn't being done just because there's dukkha here. If there's dukkha and you do what you can to alleviate it and you alleviate it, wonderful. And if you do the best you can to alleviate it and you can't alleviate it, you did the best you could. When metta goes out into the world and encounters rejoicing, happiness, then it rejoices with those who are rejoicing. This is mudita. We don't even have a word in English that corresponds to this. We have a word for the far enemy, which is envy. But not for mudita. Sometimes you hear it translated as sympathetic joy or even empathetic joy. The first time I heard the phrase sympathetic joy, that meant as much to me as mudita. I was like, huh? What's that? I actually prefer appreciative joy, because sympathetic and empathetic joy imply that mudita can only be done for others. But the Buddha is very clear that one does it to all as to oneself. You can rejoice at your own good fortune. That's mudita. And you can rejoice at the good fortune of others. That's also mudita. The far enemy, like I said, is envy. The near enemy is rejoicing, but shall we say, being identified or attached to the one that you're rejoicing in terms of. If your kid comes home from school and they have very good grades and you're rejoicing, is it mudita? What if the neighbor's kid comes home from school and they have even better grades? Do you rejoice even more? Or was there some attachment there? If the Seahawks win the Super Bowl and you're all happy, is this mudita? Because a bunch of grown men playing a violent kids game won the last game of the season? Well, no. You've identified with this team and they've won, and now you're rejoicing because you picked the right team to identify with. It was very interesting during the Winter Olympics that was held in Canada 4 years ago. When it came to the finals of ice hockey, I'm sure the Canadians here remember very distinctly, it was the Canadians versus the Americans. And the Americans had defeated the Canadians earlier. Now, Americans care about ice hockey, well, I won't say totally not at all, but pretty close to that. Whereas Canadians care about ice hockey, well, probably more than anything else except maybe their beer, right? So which was going to make a better story? That the mean old Americans win and nobody really cares about it, or the Canadians win, the sport that they care most about? Well, it was pretty obvious which was going to make the most interesting and heartfelt story. And so I was cheering for the Canadians, and they won, and it made a great story. And I could really appreciate it. I wasn't identified with the Americans just because I got born south of that line that they drew up there imaginarily. Mudita recognizes rejoicing and just rejoices along with it. It doesn't have attachment involved. And then upekkha. So metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha, equanimity. When the dukkha is encountered, it's encountered with an even-mindedness and doesn't get freaked out, doesn't panic. And when the joy is encountered, it rejoices with an even-mindedness. Doesn't get overly exuberant towards police cars or whatever. Okay? Upekkha is the mind state that the Buddha definitely felt was the supreme mind state. It shows up in the seven factors of awakening as the seventh factor. Very clearly, this is what the Buddha is pointing to, the state of Nibbana. It's a state, it's a mind state, it's a realization, and the emotional content of that realization is equanimity. Even-mindedness. In talking with people about the talk from last night during the interviews today, I want to make sure people get the idea that the realization of Nibbana is not a spacing out. Equanimity is not a spacing out. Equanimity is being fully present with what's going on, totally caring, and not getting freaked out. Nibbana is being totally present with what's going on, but not chopping the world up into bits and pieces and liking this one and not liking that one. It's just being with the happening of the moment. The far enemy of equanimity is being upset, being freaked out, panic. The near enemy is indifference, apathy. It looks like you're not getting upset, but the reason you're not getting upset is because you're not engaged. When I was in college, some of the students called a meeting about apathy. It was a feeling that the campus was really pretty apathetic. Of course, no one came to the meeting. That's not equanimity. Okay. Equanimity is being fully present there. And yeah, if you manage to alleviate the dukkha with your compassionate action, great. And if you don't alleviate the dukkha with your compassionate action and it was the best you could do, well, it was the best you could do. And if somebody's rejoicing, you rejoice with them. That's it. You don't identify with them or anything else. You just appreciate the joy. And so I want to translate mudita as appreciative joy these days. So these are the four Brahma Viharas, the four supreme emotions, as Ayakema puts it. This is a very important practice. If you get skilled in this practice, it'll take you a long ways. It'll take you beyond the place of acting selfish, both in terms of greed and hatred. Overcoming greed and hatred is what's necessary to reach the third stage of awakening. And these four emotional states are the states we want to practice. Practice by sending it to ourselves and to everyone else without limit. Any questions or comments?
I understand the difficulty about the mudita. In my language, we would differentiate between feeling joy for someone or with someone. So I'd rather say, for someone. I understand you say rejoicing with, but I say rejoicing for, because then it's not about yourself, it's about the other.
Right, that's a very interesting thing. So in German, you have enjoy for and enjoy with. And you enjoy someone else's joy because they're joyful. So you're enjoying with them, but you're really enjoying for them. Yeah, interesting, beautiful. And of course, if it's your own good fortune, you're doing it both with and for as well. Equanimity. There are some of what's recorded that are more towards compassion. I don't remember her ever doing any guided Brahma Vihara practice on mudita or equanimity, but I could be wrong. I don't think I have a transcript of anything like that, but I'm pretty sure I don't have transcripts of everything that she did.
The reason I ask is the images that you've given us throughout the two meetings are beautiful. Sometimes I get tired of the traditional words.
Right.
So I was wondering about images for the other three.
Yeah. I think there's a couple that are somewhat more in the area of compassion, but I don't remember what they are. And I don't remember anything for the others, so you'll have to come up with your own images. It's perfectly okay to take Ayakema's idea and come up with your own metta or mudita practice doing that. The one that I did about the kitchen with the soup, that was a student of mine who heard Ayakema do hers and got inspired and came up with the kitchen with the soup. Mm-hmm. So you can feel free to make up your own images. Other questions?
Yeah, you said that it was really, really important practice. But at the same time, I mean, I don't know the whole canon by heart or I haven't read it, but it feels like it's not spoken of very often compared to all other factors.
It's spoken of, okay, so the Brahmavihara practice is spoken of probably on the order of 20 to 30 times. Okay. The gradual training, remember that? Everybody got that one now? Yeah, it shows up in 30 suttas. And that, I would say, is the heart of the Buddha's teaching there. Okay, so 30 times. I don't know exactly how many times the Brahmavihara practice shows up. It's going to be on the order of 20 to 30 times. The jhanas show up way more, definitely, no doubt about it. Abandoning the hindrances shows up a lot. Mindfulness of breathing shows up a huge amount. Mindfulness in general shows up a huge amount. So yeah, there are practices that show up more frequently, but I still think it's a really important practice. That it is necessary to train our minds in what could be called the healthy emotions. The culture we're embedded in is training us in terms of greed and hatred, basically. You know, fear and dread. All right. So I think it's a really important practice to counteract the messages that we're getting from this culture.
The word unconditional love. If all things are conditioned, could it be maybe boundless or limitless love? Or can you speak to how you...
Okay, unconditioned love means that you're loving someone and it's not based on conditions. Even though the person is based on conditions and you knowing them is based on conditions. It's just that they're a person and you love them for being a person. Not because they're your friend or they did something nice for you or anything like that. So we could say unrestricted love if you don't like conditions.
I heard that bounced around a little bit and I was wondering, very clear with...
Yeah, so unrestricted love. Okay, you're giving it out without restrictions. It would be boundless and limitless, but often what happens is people like, yeah, I'll love you and I'll love you because you're really nice, and then I'll give it to everybody and it's boundless and limitless. But those first few people, there were actually restrictions. I'm loving you because you do good stuff, right? So that's why I like unconditioned or unrestricted. Yeah, but it is boundless and limitless. But I don't think boundless and limitless catches that idea of you're giving it out without restrictions or without because.
So you could give mudita to someone who wasn't currently experiencing joy but wishing them to have joy? Or, I mean, everybody at one point or another.
I would say that you would be giving them metta when you're wishing they experience joy. That's actually metta. May you experience joy. May you be happy. The mudita is they're experiencing joy and you celebrate the fact that they're experiencing joy.
So you could celebrate somebody experiencing joy. You might not know of the joy that they're celebrating, but everybody at some time has some joy. Can you visualize them having joy and
right.
take pleasure in the joy, even if you don't know the specific joy.
Right. You're not wishing that they have joy. You're assuming that they're joyful, and you're rejoicing with their assumed joy. Yes. Yeah, you can do that. And in fact, when you're doing mudita practice, that's generally what's going on. You're sitting there with your eyes closed, and you're thinking of your friend, who, pretty happy guy, and you're, yeah, glad you're happy. Although at this particular moment, you don't know what's going on there.
And if you are doing a mudita practice, and someone comes to mind who's depressed, switch in that moment to a compassion practice, or could you just wish that they have joy?
Well, when you wish they have joy, you are doing metta practice. Okay. And it's perfectly okay to switch, right? And it could even be compassion practice that you switch to. None of this is like, oh, you fell off into metta when you were doing mudita. How terrible. You fell from one of the supreme emotions into a supreme emotion. Yeah, so it's fine.
More of a comment, if there's a lot of interesting research going on into compassion to try and bring it to the same level that we have for the cognitive improvements for mindfulness, so people are interested. CCARE at Stanford, Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, also at Berkeley, and Compassion in Organizations is being done at the University of Michigan School of Management, so if people want to look into that. It's interesting to see the same sort of scientific rigor into this being the Brahmaviharas that have been done for mindfulness.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, I had heard about the one at Stanford. Yeah, excellent.
So I thought that, I was surprised when you said that if you had to keep one practice, it would be metta, because I thought it was a concentration practice, which means that I think supposedly it doesn't lead you to enlightenment as such.
That's because you've heard that from people who were hearing that from people who had read the Visuddhimagga. In the Visuddhimagga, metta is downgraded to just a concentration practice. But you don't find it as a concentration practice in the suttas. You find it as an awakening practice that can take you to at least the third stage and perhaps the fourth. You're going to have to get some insight into not self to get fully awakened. But very definitely in the suttas, it's an awakening practice. But by the time of the Visuddhimagga, and perhaps even by the time of the Abhidhamma, where they're trying to put everything into boxes, it got stuck in the concentration box. And it's true, it will get you nice and concentrated, which is one of the reasons I like it, right? But it can take you a lot further than that as well. In the suttas, the relationship between the jhanas and metta is that you do the first jhana and then you do metta practice. You don't do metta practice to get to the jhanas. You get to the jhana and then do metta practice. So the metta is really coming along in the role of insight practice at this point, to break down the sense of separation between yourself and others.
Could you repeat the first part of that, the sequence?
In Digha Nikaya 13, you go through the gradual training up to the first jhana, and then you do Brahmavihara practice, all four of them. That's what's in the suttas. In later times, the metta and the other Brahmavihara practices were thought of only as concentration practices in order to get to the jhanas. But that's a later development. It's not what the Buddha was talking about. But that's what you find taught these days.
What seems to be the actual object when you're doing metta practice in the suttas?
I am focused on the feeling, right? So say the words, do the visualization until the feeling arises, and then I can drop whatever was generating the feeling and just stay focused on the feeling and maintain the feeling. What I'm doing in this concentration practice.
Oh,
come back.
Yes.
Is it appropriate to do metta practice when you get out of the jhanas?
Yeah, you can do metta after the jhanas. Yeah, it's probably not going to lead to a lot of insights while you're doing the metta, but then after you get up and stay mindful, the insights might come at that point. I've had that happen.
Can you speak to the maybe the distinction between equanimity as part of the fourth jhana and equanimity as one of these?
Brahma-viharas. Yeah, equanimity shows up in a number of different contexts. So, as Brahma-vihara practice, you're attempting to generate the feeling of equanimity through a phrase or phrases, through a visualization. All right, so it's sit down, get quiet, and can you put yourself into an equanimous state? That's basically what you're trying to do. For the jhanas, when you get to the fourth jhana, you have unintentionally generated pretty stable equanimity. You've gotten there indirectly, but you wind up with a much more stable feeling of equanimity. At least that's my personal experience of it. But the feeling is the same in both cases. There's this unruffledness. There's the equanimity of the seven factors of awakening, and you can practice that like you practice in the Brahma-viharas, generating it that way. But you can also practice it by stepping through the jhanas, and you're now in the fourth jhana, and you step out of the jhana, and you're in a very equanimous state, and you begin investigating reality from that place, right? So you step from number seven, equanimity of the fourth jhana, into investigation of phenomena, which is the second, by being mindful of what's happening, which is the first. There's also a stage called equanimity about sankharas. It's talked about in the Progress of Insight. And this equanimity arises after you've had a deep enough insight into the nature of reality in terms of anicca, dukkha, anatta, that it's transformative. It probably shakes you up. Your anatta, your anicca experience points out that all the things you were counting on to find security, no, they're not going to be secure. And so it kind of freaks you out. After you have integrated that, after you've come to terms with the fact that, yeah, your new view of the world in terms of anicca is indeed how it is, and you can integrate that experience, that can leave you in a state referred to as equanimity about sankharas, or high equanimity. That equanimity is even more profound and unshakable than the equanimity of the fourth jhana. At the fourth jhana equanimity, you come out, you start walking around, and eventually it wears off. At this stage, the equanimity is extremely stable. It doesn't wear off. And furthermore, you can look at something that's quite attractive, know it's attractive, and not be attracted. You can look at something that's quite disgusting, know it's disgusting, and not be disgusted. So that's high equanimity. That's the jumping off point for having a path moment, right? You get your mind into that state, and yeah, you're much more willing to let go, give up everything for the deepest truth there is. So that's four different ways that equanimity is talked about on the spiritual path.
So I think I know the answer to this question, the story of the Banyan Deers. I think speaks to this point, but and I know the Buddha said different things at different times depending on who he was talking to. One of the things I appreciate about the Metta Sutta is the metaphor, you know, this mother would protect with her life her child, her only child.
Right.
It's you know, as we talked about, I thought around on this, I prefer that to the man who leaves his husband, his wife and children, to find the meaning of life without women and children in it.
Yeah.
So the sutta you haven't talked about, there's a sutta, I think, when he's talking to King Pasanadi, who asks him, if I care for my children, you're telling me I'm going to suffer. And if I care for people, you're telling me that this is dukkha. And he goes through this catechism of, you know, all the people that you care for, and if this happens, if that happens, you'll suffer. So I guess the Banyan deer is acting like as a mother would protect with her life her child, her only child.
Exactly.
but after that moment when, like, if the mother jumps in front of a bus to protect her child, she's going to suffer if her child is hurt.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm trying to reconcile the human emotion of love and caring for people with these sublime states of non-attachment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the human emotion of love can get even better and grow into these sublime states. Yeah, so there might be attachment there to begin with. And maybe that's as far as we get. Right? But it's possible to even get more profound, more deep, more caring, and get even beyond the attachment. At least this is what the Buddha is saying.
But he left his wife and his child, his only child.
That's the story that we get. You know what we get in the suttas? He left his parents. We don't even get that Rahula was his son in the suttas. We just get there's this apparently kid, Rahula, who grows up and eventually becomes enlightened, who had a pretty close relationship with the Buddha. So
I thought it was his son and he named his son Fetter.
That Rahula means fetter, but we don't know for sure it was his son. Okay? That's in the stories in the Vinaya. And maybe they're accurate, maybe they're not. All that we can say is this is what took place. And that it was a pretty good investment he made because he came back and his wife and his son both became arahants. And so did a lot of other relatives. So he left them in pretty good stead. I mean, they weren't like left on the street or anything. But he did indeed leave them, if the story is true. But, you know, he came back. And he came back with something far greater than he could have ever given by staying. So, yeah, it's a little hard to reconcile. And it's also we're trying to reconcile it with our 20th and 21st century view of society. And we don't really know what it was like then. And it was an extended family society as well. So, and women were treated as property. So there was, yeah, it was different. So.
And didn't they believe that great merit accrued to the family too if you went on a spiritual quest?
Yeah, well, that's usually what's said. Now, merit. You know, there's no merit bank up there.
Just in terms of, you know, would it be, if he did leave his wife and child, then he had to justify leaving them.
Yeah. I mean, certainly how it turned out, it was a really cool thing to do because it gave them a great boon in the end. So, yeah, it was a meritorious action.
So this touches upon the question of creating dukkha for a greater future good.
Yeah, sometimes that's what's necessary. Sometimes you have to grab the kid and jerk them out from in front of the bus, and you jerk them so hard it hurts their arm, but that's creating dukkha rather than let them get run over by the bus. sometimes you think you're doing a greater good by creating some harm, and it turns out not to be the case. Yeah, it's a tricky life out there. Pay attention to your motivation. That's the most important thing. Try and see what's behind your motivation. If you're acting out of fear, you might not be making the wise decision. If you're acting out of love, that's a lot better place to be coming from.
So how are you going to act out of love, throwing your kid out on in front of the bus? How are you going to create act out of love, creating dukkha?
You grab the kid and drag them out from in front of the bus, and you grab them so hard it hurt their arm.
So there's no possibility of creating dukkha for a bigger, as he said.
I don't understand the question.
Maybe I misunderstood. Because I understood that the question was about the creating dukkha for a greater good, right?
Yes, greater and future.
Future good.
Yeah.
So, but you cannot act out of love when you create dukkha for a future good.
Well, you're not acting to create dukkha, you're acting to create the future good, and it produces present dukkha.
Present dukkha. So you've caused dukkha.
Yeah.
So that's not acting out of love.
If you grab the kid and jerk them out of in front of the bus, that's acting out of love. But you hurt their arm, you jerk them so hard. That's causing dukkha.
But if you leave the kid,
That's going to cause dukkha too.
I'm off to find. I mean, not everyone is the Buddha, but.
Right. Okay. So you leave and you go off to find your fortune. You come back broke. Yeah, you blew it. You leave the kid. You go off to find your fortune. You come back and you can afford to send the kid to a good school and they get a great education and they have a wonderful life. Well, you succeeded. Right. We don't know how it's going to turn out. Look at your motivation. Right? And try and use some wisdom. I can't tell any of you what to do. I can tell you how to get to the jhanas, but I have trouble running my own life. I don't want to take on anybody else's. Right? So act in a way as best you can that doesn't cause dukkha and makes life better for yourself and everyone else. But yeah, sometimes it's not clear.
Yeah, and things that appear one way at one time appear a very different way another time.
Yeah, exactly.
Another area, I wonder whether gratitude could be included as well in appreciative joy, because it's some kind of recognition of good.
Yeah, so part of celebrating your own good fortune is to be grateful for it. Part of wrongly celebrating your own good fortune is look at me, see how wonderful I am, or anything like that. But being grateful for it, yeah, that would be part of it for sure. Definitely.
Or recognition of what you receive from others.
Yeah. And gratitude that someone you love is experiencing joy. Yeah. Okay, so in just a moment, there's not going to be a break. There's going to be closing metta and the sharing of merits. So a couple of things to say. Break silence tomorrow. See if you can avoid talking of kings, ministers, armies, dangers, wars, and all the other unedifying conversations. It would be highly wrong speech to go up to somebody and say, I got 3 jhanas, how many did you get? Right? So, yeah, you could ask somebody if they had a good retreat, and you can talk about your retreat, but yeah, don't get caught in trying to one-up somebody else's retreat with your retreat or anything like that. everyone has to come to breakfast at the usual time, 7 o'clock, and everybody has to talk to other people. There's nobody allowed to go off by yourself. If I see you sitting by yourself, I will come and make you talk to other people. And I want to eat my breakfast in peace. Right? You can sit out front and talk to people if you want to. You can sit at the tables and talk to people. You can go in, sit by the fire that's not burning in the lounge area and talk to people. But everybody's got to start talking. Don't be attached to the silence. It will lead to your dukkha. Right? You've got to start coming back because it's crazy out there. And one of the best ways to get yourself grounded again is to practice talking to other people. I'm not going to do divide up into dyads and now we'll talk sort of thing. Although, yeah. It's been suggested, but I know there are people that would really appreciate if I don't do that, so I'm not. Okay, so I'm just going to assume that all of you are going to talk to other people, and I'm going to go around counting heads. If you're not there, I have to go find you, and I want to eat my breakfast. So please, everybody come down and talk to some other people. If you're on the shuttle, get packed and get your luggage ready to go before you start your final chore. Okay, we're not going to wait for you to pack when the shuttle's ready to leave. Right? Then you're going to be really stuck. So get yourself packed. If you can't quite finish your final chore, okay, somebody else will have to do it after you. But get yourself ready to go.
How is the volcano?
How is?
The volcano.
The volcano. The one in Iceland?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a volcano in Iceland that's threatening to make things interesting. It hasn't done anything yet except threaten to make things interesting.
But I'm going that way tomorrow.
You're going that way. You'll be fine tomorrow, most likely. Okay? There's no guarantees, though. Yeah, there's a volcano that could do the same thing the one did in 2010. Yeah. But then again, it might not do anything. And so far, it hasn't done anything except threat. If you want an update on the news of the world, you can talk to me tomorrow. I'll tell you all about it. It's just the same old stuff. Okay. So what else? I think that's it. Other than, I'm going to ring the bell slightly before 7 in the morning. Okay? And come in here and help you put all of the stuff away. Everything, all these chairs and cushions and everything needs to go back in this closet in here. It'll work best if two people will go in the closet and we hand stuff to them rather than everybody trying to get through the doorway. All right? So we'll do that. And when you leave here to go to breakfast, take everything that belongs to you. Don't think I'll come back and get it. People have to clean in here, and they don't want to clean around your stuff. And Cloud Mountain doesn't want your stuff, all right? And they won't send it to you. So take all of your stuff. And if you're not coming to the sitting before breakfast, take all of your stuff tonight when you leave, okay? Any questions about any of that?
Can we go ahead and put our stuff away tonight if we're not coming tomorrow?
I'd say just take all of your stuff and we'll put it away in the morning. Okay, when we're putting stuff away, don't put away the sitting places for the staff. I think there's two of those in the back. All right, so leave those there. And everything else we'll put away. I think this chair will stay here, but all the other stuff goes. Any other questions? Okay, so turn the lights down if you want to stand up for literally just a second to do that. Thank you. order to begin, please put your attention on your breath for a few moments. One last thing before I start the metta. Thank you. Thank you for your practice. Thank you for your questions. Thank you for your comments. And thank you for your generosity.